Inheritance. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with the American Legion, presents a story out of that great composite of visions, struggles, and victories of the American past. Our inheritance. Yes, we Americans are heirs to a vast fortune, a fortune compounded of many things. Of militiamen drilling on the village green. Of Ethan Allen and his Green Mountain Boys. The voice of a great bell proclaiming liberty. It is the swift clipper ships and East India trade. And the Pony Express feeding news across half a nation. Let us now go back to a significant chapter in America's history, one which we all share in our inheritance. The greatest engineering feat of the 19th century was the building of the first transcontinental railroad in the 1860s. It had to be built through an unsettled country of vast distances, across prairies filled with warlike Indians and over the highest mountain ranges in the United States. While a transcontinental railroad had been discussed for some years, it was not until 1853 that Congress ordered the Army to find a practicable and economical route to the Pacific Ocean. 2 years later, five possible routes were reported on, but Congress had spent $340,000 on the surveys, all it intended to. So private railroads took up the work and sent out their own engineers. Among them was Grenville M. Dodge. On a hot August afternoon in 1859, young Dodge was sitting and rocking on the front veranda of the Pacific Hotel in Council Bluffs, Iowa, when a tall, gaunt man strolled over to him.
Excuse me, sir, but you've been pointed out to me as Mr. Grenville Dodge.
That's right.
I understand you've made a number of surveys west of here for the Mississippi and Missouri Railroad.
Yes, sir.
Along the routes surveyed by the government?
Partly along those routes. I think I've located a better one.
You have? What one is that, Mr. Dodge?
The line following the Platte River west from Omaha. It has the fewest obstacles to overcome, the lowest grades, the least curvature of all.
Is that your own private opinion?
Not exactly, sir. I really can't claim to have discovered it all by myself.
Why do you say that?
Well, first of all, this route was originally made by the buffalo. Next, the Indians used it, then the fur traders. The Mormons followed it 12 years ago. And later, the overland emigrants to California and Oregon.
I can see why you can't claim to have discovered it first.
No, sir. But so far as I know, I'm the only engineer who has surveyed and carefully examined it.
You think a transcontinental railroad should follow that route?
I do, if the government is to save money and time and effort.
That's good. I've long had a keen interest in what our government does. I shall keep in mind what you have said.
Excuse me, sir. I don't believe I caught your name.
Oh, did I forget to introduce myself? I'm sorry. I'm a lawyer from Springfield, Illinois. My name is Abraham Lincoln.
Thus, the man who was to become the 16th president of the United States received first-hand information about the best route for a railroad to the Pacific. With the start of the Civil War, Grenville Dodge, who had had previous military experience, was commissioned a colonel and eventually became a major general. In June 1863, General Dodge received an order to report to Washington. President Lincoln wished to see him. Puzzled, he went to the White House.
You wish to see me, Mr. President?
Oh, yes, General Dodge. Very much so.
I trust I've done nothing wrong, sir.
Wrong? Oh, no, indeed, General Dodge. I wish your advice.
My advice, Mr. President?
Yes. You see, the railroad to build east will start from Sacramento, but Congress, when it passed the Railroad Act of 1862, refused to commit itself as to where the other railroad should start west. They left that up to me.
I see, sir.
If I remember correctly, 4 years ago, you said the railroad should start from the city of Omaha.
That is correct, sir.
Are you still of the same opinion?
I've had no reason to change it, Mr. President. The line should be constructed...
with the fewest obstacles to be overcome, the lowest grades, and the least curvature.
I believe those were my exact words, Mr. President.
They stuck with me, General Dodge. Very well, I'm satisfied that the railroad should start at Omaha in the territory of Nebraska.
Mr. President, what is the name of the new railroad?
Since one of the main purposes is to knit California even closer to the Union, the line building westward is to be called the Union Pacific Railroad.
Union Pacific. That's a very good name, Mr. President.
It does have a patriotic ring, General Dodge.
So, both starting points were set. Omaha in the east, Sacramento in the west. A brave, groundbreaking ceremony marked the start of the California chartered Central Pacific at Sacramento on January 8, 1863. On the water-soaked levee of the American River, a large crowd gathered. Leland Stanford, newly elected governor of California and president of the Central Pacific, stepped forward.
Gentlemen, you are gathered here on a momentous occasion, one which will live in history. Today, the first spadeful of earth will be turned to signal the start of a great transcontinental railroad. This work will go on, I assure you, with no delay, no halting, and no uncertainty in its continued progress. With this dirt from the foothills of the high Sierras, the Central Pacific Railroad is begun. Yeah!
But the brave beginning was no signal for unprecedented speed in railroad building. All supplies for the Central Pacific had to be shipped from the east around Cape Horn, which took a sailing ship some 4 months to complete. Important freight, such as locomotives and rail, could be transported across the Isthmus of Panama, but this route was extremely costly. The Central Pacific moved slowly eastward. At the end of 2 years of work, in January 1865, just 31 miles of track had been laid. Principal trouble was lack of money. But it was not the only problem on that Western Railroad, as was soon learned by Charles Crocker, chief of construction, and his superintendent, James H. Strobridge.
All right, Joe, carry on with what you have.
What's this all about, Mr. Strobridge? Where are all the men?
They're gone, all but about 100.
Gone? But they can't. They signed on for this job. They can't leave.
They have, Mr. Crocker. You can see for yourself.
Well, where do they go, and why?
Rumors of gold found up near the Yuba River hit camp last night, so they just took off.
But we can't build a railroad without men.
I agree, Mr. Crocker.
We can't get any more workers except from San Francisco. Nobody left except... Except...
Yes, Mr. Crocker?
There are some Chinese available.
Chinese? Oh, no. Who ever heard of building a railroad with Chinese laborers?
Nobody has. Yet.
This work is too hard. A man has to be big and strong and husky. Chinese would never stand up under such rough work.
I don't know. They might. Don't forget, Mr. Strobridge, their ancestors built the Great Wall of China. I guess they can dig the right of way for an American railroad.
At Crocker's insistence, 50 Chinese laborers were brought out from San Francisco. They went to work quietly and efficiently under their own boss, whose responsibility it was to keep the work going. So successful was the experiment with those first 50 Chinese that Crocker eventually hired men from southern China. At one time, there were almost 12,000 Chinese at work on building the Central Pacific. Meanwhile, the Union Pacific, building west from Omaha, was far behind in its work, too. Arguments over the best route had delayed work nearly 2 years. Dr. Thomas E. Durant, vice president of the Eastern Road, finally persuaded General Dodge to take a leave of absence from the Army and join the railroad as chief engineer. On May 1st, 1866, General Dodge arrived to take over his new job.
Well, General Dodge, I'm glad to see you.
Good morning, Dr. Durant. Well, I'm here. General Grant finally gave me leave of absence to help you.
I didn't tell you how glad I am. You know John Casement?
How do you do, General Dodge?
John Casement? Are you the Casement who was brevetted Brigadier General by President Lincoln for his services at the Battle of Franklin?
I am, sir.
Well, I am glad to meet you, General Casement.
Oh, thank you, sir.
Now, Mr. Casement, General Casement, now has charge of construction work along the Union Pacific.
Oh, that's good. How long have you been in charge, General?
Only a few weeks, sir.
And the improvement he's made already, it's unbelievable.
Well, the problem of labor isn't so difficult now with the Civil War over.
Oh, you're using ex-soldiers?
Whenever I can, sir.
From the northern side, I presume?
I never asked that question, sir. It is important only that they were soldiers, understand discipline, and know how to shoot. in case of attack by the Indians.
Good. Oh, by the way, Dr. Durant, how's our rival railroad coming along out west?
Well, not too fast, General. I've heard they're only a little beyond Colfax. That's 55 miles from Sacramento.
That's almost as far along as we are.
Yes, but they're now in the Sierra Nevadas. Work is slowing up. I've heard there's a tunnel to be dug through solid rock at some...
Are you sure about all this, Dr. Durant?
Well, it's what I've heard. Not directly, of course.
We must learn the facts directly. Send a man at once to the Pacific Coast to learn the exact state of construction on the Central Pacific Railroad. We don't want to dally along and then find they're beating us in the race to finish the railroad.
Very well, General Dodge. I'll send a man overland at once.
Jim Dayton, special representative of the Union Pacific, was given the job. And on a November day in 1866, arrived at the rival Central Pacific construction camp in California. Trains were running to the town of Cisco, 94 miles east of Sacramento, but work now appeared headed for difficulties.
Hey, can you tell me where I can find Charles Crocker?
Mr. Crocker in boxcar there. His home.
Thanks. Say, do you always have snows like this?
Oh, no. Summertime, no snow. Wintertime, plenty snow.
Sure, sure. Is this the place?
Yeah, that bossman car.
Much obliged. Mr. Crocker, I'm from the Union Pacific. Could I talk to you?
Sure, man. Come in out of the storm.
Thank you.
Yeah. Sit down by that stove and thaw out.
Thank you.
Oh, Mary.
Yes, Charles?
Get this young man some coffee. I think he can use it. It's quite a storm we're having. Been going on for the last 2 days.
So I understand. Excuse me, Mr. Crocker. I'm Jim Dayton from the Union Pacific at Omaha. Dr. Durant...
I'm glad to know you, Mr. Dayton.
Here's your coffee, young man.
And this is my wife.
Thank you, Mrs. Crocker. Sir, Dr. Durant was a bit worried about how you were getting along out here.
Oh, that's considerate of him. Well enough, I suppose. How are things going back east?
Well, fairly well, sir, but we've had it easy so far. No mountains, just follow the Platte River west. But you here on the Central Pacific, why, you're already deep in the mountains.
Yeah, looks like we're stuck.
Well, how's that, Mr. Crocker? You mean the snow?
Snow isn't the worst of it. There's a tunnel up ahead at Summit. It's going to be about 1,700 feet long. And it's got to be dug out of solid granite.
Oh. Will it hold up construction, or can you build a temporary track around the mountain?
A temporary track? What could we hang it on? That mountain goes almost straight up.
I didn't realize that. Well, sir, how long do you estimate it will take to dig the tunnel?
Well, with luck, we should have it through in about 3 years.
As long as that?
It's solid granite. We've been at it 3 weeks now and have barely dented it.
Some more hot coffee, Mr. Dayton?
No, thank you, ma'am. Mr. Crocker, could I inspect the tunnel work done so far?
Sure. Don't see why not. And if you have any ideas about how to cut it through faster, please let me know.
I will, of course, sir.
I'll let my construction superintendent show you around. I'm staying close to home today.
Don't blame you. Where will I find him, Mr. Crocker?
Just ask anyone where James Strawbridge is. They'll point him out to you.
Well, thank you, Mrs. Crocker. Good day to you, sir.
Hello, young man. So they sent a spy, did they?
Why, what do you mean, Charles? He seems like a very nice young man.
My dear Mary, I grant you that. But did it ever occur to you to wonder why Dr. Durant of the rival railroad is so solicitous about our progress?
Well, I suppose...
He wanted to know what we're up against. And now he knows. 3-year tunnel building job lies ahead.
But how does that help him?
Don't you see, Mary? Dr. Durant now thinks he has plenty of time to proceed with building his railroad from the east and easily beat us into the Salt Lake Valley in Utah.
With 3 years for your tunnel here, it looks like he has.
Yes, Mary. And I want it to look that way. Strawbridge, we've got to figure out some way to speed up this work. We can't just sit here 3 years waiting for a tunnel to be built.
You're right, Crocker. I'm doing everything possible to rush the work. Send a crew over the mountain to start work on the tunnel from the other side.
Well, that helps some, but it's not enough.
You still insist on using black powder for blasting?
Sure, it's the best and cheapest way to blast, isn't it?
Well, it's cheapest in cost, all right, but why not try nitroglycerin?
What's that?
It's a new explosive invented by a Swedish chemist. Name of Nobel, I think.
Is it any good?
They claim it's 8 times as powerful as black powder.
Eight
time.
And it can be used in small holes.
Well, that'd reduce drilling costs and speed up excavation.
That's right.
We could just have more room for more workmen.
Well, there are only two ends to a tunnel. You can use only so many men.
Strawbridge, what if there were four ends to this tunnel?
Four ends? I don't know what you mean.
All right, look. Suppose we sink a shaft from the top of the mountain about halfway between the two tunnel openings. We install a hoisting engine, and then we can work from both ends and both ways from the middles.
Hey, that's a good idea.
All right, let's get to work on it.
Boss man, talk you?
Yeah, sure, Ling. What is it?
Men not happy, boss. They want work.
What do they care? They get paid just the same.
That not it, boss. They unhappy not working.
Well, look, Ling. There's only so much work can be done on the tunnel. And we're using as many others as we can building the snow sheds.
Many men still not work.
I can't do anything about it.
They say work other side.
Other side? What are you talking about?
Other side, big mountain.
But we've got to get the tunnel through. Say, maybe you've got an idea there.
Yes, boss. Good idea, no?
If we could haul locomotives and supplies over the mountain and down to Donner Lake, but can it be done?
Can what be done, Strawbridge?
Well, if we could just get started building track on the other side of the mountains, we wouldn't have to hold up work for the summit tunnel and...
Yeah, but how are you going to get the materials over the mountains?
China boy. Haul engine. Haul supply. Haul everything.
But we haven't any sledges big enough to carry a locomotive.
And we'll make special sledges. We'll use logs split down the middle and rounded at the ends.
All right, but who can haul a 20-ton locomotive up a mountainside?
Sure, boss. China boy haul. Keep him busy.
All right, let's try it, Strawbridge. We may keep up with that other railroad yet.
That winter, the Chinese workers hauled 3 locomotives, 40 freight cars, and enough material for 50 miles of track from Cisco across the summit and down to Donner Lake, a distance of more than 20 miles. By spring, many miles of track had been laid on the eastern side of the mountains. In August of 1867, Summit Tunnel was completed, dug through in 1 year instead of the predicted 3. Early in 1868, the great race between the two railroads was on in earnest to see which could build further before they met. Each mile of track laid meant a prize of from $64,000 to $96,000 for the contending railroad. Construction went ahead at breakneck speed. The Union Pacific stepped up track laying, and on one occasion, an impressive record was set. Dr. Durant lost no time in writing this fact to Charles Crocker, his rival in the West.
Well, I'll be a blue-eyed mud turtle. Why, that lop-eared polecat.
Oh, take it easy, Mr. Crocker. What's troubling you?
It's that braggart, Tom Durant. He writes me... Here, listen to this. As you undoubtedly will be envious to learn, the Union Pacific last week, in a single working day, laid down 8.5 miles of track.
Yeah, that's quite a record.
Yeah, and he goes on. Inasmuch as I feel quite confident this will remain a world's record for all time, I am willing to bet you $10,000 that the Central Pacific cannot exceed that mark. Most cordially, and so on. Why, that inflated...
Are you going to call his bet?
Call it? Call it? How can I? We've never laid more than 5 miles of track in any one day.
We could double it if we wanted to.
How?
Well, the Union Pacific back east claims to have all the Irishmen. But out here in the west, we have some Irish, too. Big, brawny men. They'd handle the iron.
Then you mean with the Chinese handling the ties?
And the spiking and bolting. It can be done.
Good. We'll beat that eastern record yet. Now, when do you want to do it?
Well, this will take some organizing. I suggest we wait until the end of April.
Very well, Mr. Strawbridge. And I'll try to be a patient man until I can make that Durant eat his words.
Strawbridge carefully selected the 8 Irishmen who were to be the starting rail gang. Then he organized a second gang to take over if the first should get tired. But Patrick Joyce, leader of the first gang, had other ideas about the matter.
And I hear the boss is for having a gang to relieve us when we get tired.
Patrick, we might get tired.
Sure, Michael Sullivan. And we might get thirsty, too. So we'll take a drink and go right on.
Well, there's a lot of iron in 9 miles of track.
Ah, but it's nothing compared to the muscles and iron will of a determined Irishman. Agreed, boys?
Right.
On the morning of April 28, 1869, with representatives of the Union Pacific looking on, the attempt to set a new record was begun by the Western Railroad.
All right, boys. Wait until our Chinese have put down about 80 ties. That'll get them far enough ahead of us so we won't be running into them. Let's see. That's about... That's enough. All right now, boys. Grab the rail and let's go!
After the first rail was laid, the others followed at the rate of about 240 feet of rail every 147 seconds. Seemingly tireless, the eight Irishmen continued their breakneck speed until noon.
All right, men, now go for lunch.
And we've really worked up an appetite, Mr. Strawbridge. How much time for lunch?
Half hour be enough.
Well, now, let's see. How much track have we put down?
Mr. Crocker, how much track has been laid?
8 miles and 75 feet.
Well, now then, Mr. Strawbridge, don't you think we ought to be having a full hour for lunch?
Of course, Patrick. Take as long as you want.
We'll beat those eastern braggarts without a bit of trouble. We're almost up to their mark and only half the day gone. How's the rail gang holding up?
Yeah, pretty well, but I've got a fresh gang that's
Now, if you'll excuse me, sir. We'd rather have no strangers working in our place.
But you eight men have done more than a full day's work already, Patrick.
But it's not that, sir. We're still fairly fresh, and we'd like a chance to see the job through.
Very well, Patrick. Carry on.
At the end of a 12-hour day, that rail gang had laid exactly 10 miles and 200 feet of track. Incredible though it may seem, eight Irishmen, Patrick Joyce, Michael Sullivan, Thomas Daly, Michael Shea, George Wyatt, Edward Killeen, Michael Kennedy, and Fred McNamara, handled more than 3,500 rails that day, 1,000 tons of iron. Their track-laying record remains unbroken today. May 10th, 1869 was the big day. When the last section of track should be laid, the last spike driven to join the two railroads into one great Pacific Railroad. The ceremony was to be north of Ogden at a point called Promontory. The Union Pacific Special from the east arrived first. Then from the west came the Central Pacific train with Governor Stanford. Of the hundreds present, only Patrick Joyce appeared worried.
Hi, Mr. Strawbridge. Can I be asking you a question, sir?
Of course, Patrick Joyce. What is it?
What's that polished rail tie doing there?
You mean that one made out of California laurel? Well, it's to be the last tie laid down on the line.
Oh? Well, the last tie, huh? Well, now, sir, seeing as how we made sort of a record, how about me and the boys putting in the last tie? To sort of celebrate.
I'd like nothing better, Patrick, but other arrangements have been made by those in charge.
Oh? And who's to do the job?
Representatives of both railroads, Mr. Samuel Reed from the east and I from the west, have been ordered to lay the last tie.
Oh, well, that's all right then, sir. I just didn't want them eastern boys trying to steal the show.
The California laurel tie was put in place. The last two rails were laid and fastened down except for the last four spikes. A spike of silver from Nevada, one of gold from Montana, and one of gold, silver, and iron from Arizona were driven. Then came the moment when the fourth and last spike, one of gold from the state of California, was to be driven.
Quiet, men. Quiet. Quiet. Governor Stanford, president of the Central Pacific, has a few words to say.
With the driving of this last gold spike, the mountain and desert shall have been overcome, and our great nation will be linked from coast to coast by rails of iron.
Hooray! Hooray!
And now, General Dodge, chief engineer of the Union Pacific.
Gentlemen, this ceremony marks the completion of a great railroad, built under difficulties and hardships and dangers never before encountered. It will remain forever a monument to the courage, skill, and determination of the men of many races and nationalities who built it.
Hooray! Hooray!
To waiting crowds and cities throughout the nation, each blow in the driving of the last spike was transmitted by telegraph. Finally, the last blow was struck and the gold spike driven home. The two locomotives, the Jupiter and the number 116, slowly moved toward each other over the completed track until they touched pilots. A bottle of champagne was smashed against the last rail as in the christening of a ship, and the great job was complete. Thus, the Great Pacific Railroad was finished a full 7 years ahead of the time limit set by Congress. The building of that first transcontinental railroad, under incredible hardships and hazards, has become a great and thrilling chapter in our inheritance. You have been listening to Inheritance, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with the American Legion. We are privileged this evening to hear from the past National Commander of the American Legion, Department of West Virginia, Mr. Donald R. Wilson.
American Legion Junior Baseball is the largest organized amateur athletic program in the world. Now in its 28th year of operation, it is based on the concept that healthy participation in competitive sport makes better citizens of the nation's youth. This summer, hundreds of thousands of boys in communities throughout the country are playing on American Legion teams, sponsored and financed by local Legion posts. The climax of the season is the Junior Baseball World Series, to be held this year at Yakima, Washington, from September 1st to September 5th. Under the overall supervision of the Legion's Americanism Commission, the program teaches the value of courage, loyalty, fair play, team spirit, and physical fitness. Only one of many post-sponsored community service projects, the program entails a cost of around $2,500 for a single Legion post to finance and maintain a team for a season. Now, a $30 million a year activity, its continual expansion has been aided by financial assistance from interested organizations and individuals, and an annual $60,000 contribution by Major League Baseball. A byproduct of this youth training program is some of the finest talent in the history of the game. 230 of America's Major League ballplayers are graduates of American Legion Junior Baseball. Al Rosen and Roy Campanella, American and National League's most valuable players in 1953, are Legion graduates, as are Yogi Berra, Ted Williams, Pee Wee Reese, and Bob Feller. But the most important product of the American Legion Junior Baseball program is a better citizenry, enriched by the millions who learned early how to play the game the American way, according to the principles that are our inheritance.
Thank you, Mr. Donald R. Wilson. Next week, Inheritance will take you on another journey through the pages of history to a time when Americans dreaming of the future forged that which we possess today. Today's story, Rails to the Pacific, was written by Ted Weir and featured Whitfield Connor as General Dodge, Lyle Talbot as James Strobridge, and Howard Culver as Charles Crocker. Included in the cast in order of their appearance were Marvin Miller, Jack Haddock, Kurt Martell, Herb Ellis, James McCallion, Maudie Prickett, Dennis Patrick. The original music was composed and conducted by Robert Armbruster. Inheritance is produced and directed for the National Broadcasting Company and the American Legion by Albert McCleary. This is John Wall speaking. Tonight, hear Meet the Press on the NBC Radio Network.